Hoff's Hut. Does anybody know what Hoff's Hut is? Okay. I grew up in Southern California, Long Beach, California specifically. Hoff's Hut was the location of my first date with Abby. Hoff's Hut is a restaurant that I don't think it any longer exists. At least the one that we went to on 2nd Street in Long Beach no longer exists. But that's where we went on our first date. I am embarrassed. I was 16 years old. She was 17. And I didn't know it was a date. I didn't know it was a date because I my perception of Abby was that, well, she's a year older. She's as tall as I am. I found her to be very beautiful and thought there is no way, like in my realm of cognitive abilities as a 16-year-old, which is pretty low, was like there's no way that this would actually be a date. She's bored and has nothing else to do this summer, and we're working on this staff team together with a day camp, and so she's bored and just going to hang out. So, but what happened in Hoff's Hut changed the trajectory of our lives, of my life, of her life, and we had this conversation in Hoff's Hut, and it wasn't necessarily remarkable. I don't remember a whole lot about it. I'm told that I ordered a Cobb salad. I have no idea why I would do that. That's not like me at all. I wish I would have done something differently, but maybe that, I don't know. But what happened in that conversation in Hoff's Hut in what would that have been? Gosh, 1990, summer of 1990. And that changed the trajectory of our lives. We got to know each other. Again, I didn't know it was a date, but I behaved and engaged in such a way that it could later turn into a date. And so that was wonderful. And so then we started dating soon thereafter, and that was great. But Hoff's Hut was a meal that she and I shared. Again, apparently it was not a good one for me, but I didn't care what I was eating. I cared that she was willing to spend time with me and talk to me. But that affected the rest of our lives. You have a meal like that. If you thought about it long enough, you can remember a time where you sat down with somebody and it changed the trajectory of your life, of a relationship, of the way that you thought about something, of what you were doing for the next 10 years of your life. We have these moments in our life where we can point to and say, I did this on this night and this evening or at this lunch meeting or at this brunch meeting, and it affected me in some way that I'm changed and it forever affected me. We've been looking at these meals through the book of Luke, the third book in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, and then Luke. And in Luke, there's all these meals that Jesus shares with people, and that's his intention over and over and over again, to change the way that people thought and how they lived and what course their life took. And so we're going to look at another one today. And what Jesus is doing in this meal is, and again, we called it Holy Happy Hour, and as we're now, you know, kind of at the back end of this series, a few more weeks in it, not all of them are happy. In fact, it would have been maybe Holy Awkward Hour would have been more appropriate. Like, this is another awkward one. Jesus just makes it awkward. Not that it's not valuable and important and significant and pointing to who God is and his kingdom in this world. It's all those good things, but it's really, really awkward. And Jesus just has this habit of doing this. And we're going to look at another one today where it's really, really awkward. So what we're going to find is we're going to look at these three things that Jesus does. The first thing is he does a healing on a Friday night at this meal. So Friday night healing. Then the next thing that he does is that he offers some recommendations on a seating chart. And then the third thing that he does is tell an embarrassing story. And through these three things that we'll see, what Jesus is doing is he's trying to adjust, to refine, and to inspire the values that people have as they look at other people. And we'll see what that is along the way. And as we look at these three things, and I want to end with just a couple conversations I've had over these last few weeks that I think are relevant to what Jesus is doing here. So Luke chapter 14, start in verse 1. Luke chapter 14, verse 1 says this. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. Again, we've seen a couple of these where he sat down with Pharisees. Here's another one on the Sabbath. Sabbath starts at sundown on Friday and goes to sundown on Saturday. So we're at Friday night, most likely. He's being carefully watched by the Pharisees. There in front of him was a man suffering from an abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, who was there invited to this particular dinner, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out? Will you not immediately do some physical labor, some work, exert yourself to pull it out to save them? And they had nothing to say. So here's the Friday night healing. Again, he's being carefully watched. That's pretty important. They're now staging these meals to try to trap him and trick Jesus and be able to point him out as a false teacher or as somebody who's not helpful and to try to get rid of him. So he's carefully watching him. And they basically have planted this person who's not well, a man he's not on the normal guest list to come to this party. He's kind of on the periphery, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law most likely let this guy in. He's got some kind of an illness, and Jesus takes the bait and he heals him. He heals him on the Sabbath, which was a no-no. You're not to do any work, even if you can do these kind of healings. You're not to do that. You're not to heal on the Sabbath. Jesus is pushing the issue. He's not sidestepping it. He's not avoiding it. He's looking straight at it. And in front of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, Jesus heals this man. And then we have these two moments where he says that, where we hear that nobody spoke up. So the Pharisees and the experts in the law are trying to carefully watch and trap Jesus. And when Jesus asks them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? They don't say anything, which is not like a Pharisee or the expert in the law. Like, they talk a lot. They have strong opinions and a lot to say. And then he goes ahead and heals them. And then he says, if one of you had a child or ox and needed help saving out of a well, wouldn't you do it? And they don't answer him. They don't answer him. Jesus is helping them reevaluate their values. They have these values. They have their values are, you know, child or ox. They would value those things in their life, a person in their family, obviously, and then an animal that does a lot of work for them in order to live and survive, these things that are valuable to them. He says, wouldn't you save that? What would be more valuable, following this law of the Sabbath or these persons, family members, or animals that are important to you? So he's raising this issue. He's making it more uncomfortable and awkward. Okay, that's the Friday night healing. Second, we find this. When he noticed how the guest picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. This is the seating arrangements. He's going to go and give them recommendations of how to sit when you get together. Here he goes. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. This is like just kind of common sense. Like, if you sit in the best seat and then somebody else shows up and they're like, hey, you've got to move because this we value this person more. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So Jesus has just first on this healing, which has created this awkward tension, and he's asked these tough questions and they've not responded. And then he looks around at everybody and says, hey, I've just got some advice for you of how you find a place to sit. And what he's really talking about is humility. And he says, you operate with certain kind of cultural norms and values. You operate with this sense of kind of one-upping either. You walk into a place and you want to be at a place of prominence. You want to be above somebody else. And there's this very clear hierarchy of who's more important and who's more valuable. And where you sit is really important. And so don't overestimate yourself. Instead, just eject out of that whole system of evaluation and competition. Eject out of that completely and just take the back seat. Be actually humble in this cultural setting. Let others go in front of you. And you know what might actually happen is you might get scooted up a row or two. You might get the best seats. But take the back seat. Be humble. And then, so he said this to the whole crew, okay? He's talked to the whole group, which is like Pharisees and the teachers of the law, like, this is not what we signed up for, okay? We did not ask you to come and give us coaching on how to be humble and where to sit. So then Jesus turns and he looks specifically at the host. He says to the host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers and sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back so that you will be repaid. Jesus isn't introducing a new idea to him. Again, he's talking to the host. He's not introducing, this is how they operated. He's just calling out, hey, I know how this works. We all know how this works. There's no secret here. We know that you don't invite people just because you care about them. You invite people to serve yourself, to increase, to help you to take a half step or a full step up in the social standing. And so you invite people over and you set the table and you do the best that you can in hopes that they'll invite you back. It's this like competition thing. It's a little bit like, I don't spend a lot of time on social media, but it's like, you know, I'm gonna like them and hope that they like me back or invite me back or subscribe, or like, let's just go back and forth and we'll just, hopefully we'll rise to the top and we'll own the whole thing of social media together and we'll be the best and most popular and then everybody will pay us and we'll be rich and that kind of thing. Like, that's literally what's going on here. Like, hey, I'll do you one, you do me one, we're gonna come back and forth. And Jesus says, but when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Jesus picks a very particular list: the poor, the cripple, the lame, the blind. Jesus was at this meal, and there wasn't a single poor person there. There wasn't a single crippled person there. There wasn't a single blind person there. And there wasn't a single lame person there. He looked around and he said, these are all of the people that are missing that are not here. In fact, the one that was ill, I healed and freed him from this awkward meal and he got to leave. Look at all of yourselves. This is who is here. And not only that, but he's working off of a list that all of the experts in the law and the Pharisees would have been familiar with from Leviticus, I think it's chapter 21, verses 17 to 23. So in the Old Testament, in the books of the law, in Leviticus, there's this very clear outline that says these are the people that are not to be in the temple to worship God, which we don't have time to go into all of that today. But what Jesus is saying is, he's saying, you're looking back at that and you're leaving out these people that aren't at this table. You're leaving out the people that aren't in your game of social, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine, of going back and forth and one-upping each other so that we all get promoted and move higher and higher up the social rank. He said, there are people that don't even get to play in that game, that aren't even invited to this table, that you look at as unclean or unfit, that you leave on the margins, on the sidelines. He says, turns to the host in front of everyone and says, hey, next time you do this, what about inviting them? But he's not just throwing out just random ideas. He's actually trying to change the way that they think and the values that they hold and paint for them a different picture of what could be. And what he's saying there is, he's saying, what if you'd served a meal, not with a present value of what's going on in this temporal world, and just in the here and now alone, or what, where you're standing in society it hinges on. What if you'd served a meal with an eternal perspective? What if you changed the way that you saw people? What if you saw people that you don't see right now? What if you look at the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind? And you actually invited them to your table, and they can't do anything for you. They can't help you in the least. They can't invite you back to their better table where you can post a picture of it and go, look whose house I went to. That's not gonna happen. But he says, he ends with this: although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Jesus is saying, I wanna introduce a whole nother way of thinking to you, and it's an eternal perspective where you either don't have or you're slightly off on. And I want to give you another way of seeing people and the world and the future and what really matters. So Jesus is going big picture here. So he's just healed someone on a Friday night, which he's not supposed to do. And then he gives some recommendations on where to sit at meals and how to even host a meal. And then he moves to this third thing. After completely kind of flipping their minds or changing their minds or turning everything upside down, he gives this embarrassing story. And so he says this, verse 15, when one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, blessed is the one who will eat at the feast of the kingdom of God. Okay? This is the person, when you have an awkward meal or when you get into a debate or a fight at a family meal, and there's the person who hasn't fully engaged, has just been busy eating, and it gets so tense that they're like, hey, let's check the score. That's what this guy is doing. So this guy is listening to everything that's happening and he's so uncomfortable and he's like, I got to break this. He's like, Jesus, isn't it true that, isn't it great that we're all going to eat the feast together at the coming of the wedding supper of the Lamb in the future in the kingdom, and we're all in this together, right? We're all good, right? And Jesus says, well, thanks for that. And then he tells this embarrassing story. Listen to this. Jesus replied to that, hey, what's the score? He replies with this. A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready, which is just the normal way that this goes. When they do this thing around the meal and they invite their friends with high social standing, they say, hey, I'm going to throw a meal. It's going to be in 4 days, okay? And then when it gets to the morning of that fourth day, he goes, okay, it's all going to be ready at 5:30, so show up at 5:30. So, hey, then they got to go run through the streets and tell people, knock on the doors and go, okay, it's ready. Come on over. That's what's happening, okay? So it's now day of. It's time. It's ready. And here comes the excuses of why the people that he'd invited aren't going to come. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I have just bought a field, and I must go and see it. Please excuse me. Another said, I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. Still another said, I just got married, so I can't come. Like, lame. Like, all three of these are, like, super lame. Like, not even creative at all. Just like, I can't come. This is like well, enough of us are parents. We know this. This is how you use your kids in the first few years of their existence when they've been born. Oh, my gosh. So-and-so and so-and-so invited us over to their Halloween party again. Oh, no, we procreated. We can't make it tonight. Like, you've done that. We're not the only ones that do that, right? No, okay. Parents, you've done this. Okay, I'm feeling really exposed right now. Okay, maybe this is just confession from Tim and Abby. We've done that when our kids were little. We don't want to go there. Oh, our kid's alive and needs attention, and we can't make it. Like, this is zero effort, zero creativity. Like, they saw through this, and this is why this is an embarrassing story. Person who wants to get higher social standing says, I'm going to throw a meal and invite all the important people over. And they've all heard it. And they've RSVP'd and said yes. And now it's day of, and I'm just updating the time. And then as soon as I update the time, all of a sudden these responses come in. Oh, I can't. I got to wash my hair. I can't. The something. And it's embarrassing because it's like, I thought they were all coming, and I've set it, and I've spent money on it. I've set it up, and it looks great, and I've already posted pictures of how good the table looks, and no one is coming. And so I'm just exposed and embarrassed. And what do I do? And Jesus goes on with this story, this parable that he's made up. The servant came back and reported this to the master. Then the owner of the house became angry because he's embarrassed and ordered his servant, go out quickly to the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. There is that exact same list. Sir, the servant said, what you have ordered has been done. They've all come, the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, they all come. They're in now. They're here. But we still got some room. Then the master told his servant, go to the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet. Jesus tells this embarrassing story to challenge the way that they see the world, to challenge the way that they see people and the values that they have. And he's saying, there is an eternal perspective that I want you to start with. There are a lot of other options and ways to see people, but I want you to start with an eternal perspective. And even those that you feel are disqualified or don't matter or are marginalized or out of sight, that they don't even show up in my sight lines, that they matter to me. Jesus is telling this accomplished, educated, socially upwardly mobile crowd, hey, there's people that I care about that aren't at this table right now. There's people that I care about that you don't care about. Start seeing people differently. Start seeing people the way that I see people. And he completely flips on their heads their values and what they've been at work doing to try to better themselves. And he just blows it all up. Jesus healed somebody on a Friday night. He gave some radically different recommendations of how to sit and how to plan a dinner party. And then he tells an embarrassing story to make a point that there are people that matter to him that may not matter to us. I want to tell you about a couple conversations that I've had recently that I think relate to this quite a bit. And if I'm perfectly honest, I'm still wrestling with them, and I don't have a lot of answers. But as I read this this week and have studied it, it just seems like God's timing has brought these in together. One of them has to do with the one of, not the only, but one crisis that our city and nation finds itself in right now. And that's, what do we do and how do we treat people and view people who have entered into the United States of America illegally? This is all over the news, but it's not just on the news, right? It impacts almost each one of us. We all probably know somebody who knows somebody, or we know somebody personally who is here and doesn't have all the correct documentations and doesn't meet up to certain laws and procedures of coming in. And talking to people and knowing all that is going on with all of these issues that regards immigration right now and the responses that our government is taking to it and different parts of government having different opinions and priorities of how to respond to it. But in a conversation with a real-life person, not a screen or an update or a post, I'm saying, my kids are coming home from school asking questions about this topic because they have friends who are scared to come to school. Or they've talked to parents, or they've talked to kids whose parents are scared to leave the house. Got an email from somebody in our own community that says, I feel compelled to do something to help friends who can't even go to the grocery store right now because they're afraid of being picked up and taken. And there is a difference between reading stories about it and talking to somebody who that's personal to. And please know that I'm very well aware that the majority of people in this room right now have a story either of your own or of your parents or of close relatives that is an immigrant story. And so this isn't just theory or other people. This is literally us. And we know that it tears at our city right now. And so when Jesus says something like, there are these people that are not in your sight lines, there are these people that are valuable to me that you, whoever the you is, that you're not looking at, let's make the you us. Do we see those people? And some of us do. And some of us are those people. Some of us have neighbors and classmates. Or you're a teacher and you have students, or you're a coworker, or one of your favorite restaurants, the cook is not showing up right now, or one's going out of business because it's owned by people who are not here legally. That we don't just see the issue, but we actually see real people. And we struggle as followers of Jesus in how to respond to that because we're inundated with a lot of other options of how to respond. This is where I find Jesus' teaching so helpful, because Jesus doesn't address all of the politics of the time. He doesn't even in this story address the laws. Jesus addresses the people. And he does so with a call and a starting point of an eternal perspective. And so as we follow Jesus, we might find these things competing with one another, and Jesus very clearly elevates the eternal perspective over our current social, legal, political reality. And one of the challenges that we all, I think, feel and experience is how to live in that tension. And I also want to be really clear, I don't have anything that resolves that tension. I don't even know that Scripture has anything that resolves that tension. That is a tension we live in. Jesus is talking to people at a table, not trying to relieve their tension, but identify it and lean into it and say, we do live in a broken world. We live in a world that hasn't figured it all out. We live in a world that doesn't have the answers. We believe we have the answers. And if we were to line up and share what we think, my guess is that we would almost to a person have a different opinion. And there might be some alignment. There would be a lot of competing ideas and a lot of friction, I bet. So Jesus speaks into us at this moment when we have this tension of the eternal perspective and the reality of the society and world and moment that we live in. And so one thing I'd consider is that Jesus may actually be calling us to very different things. I think he's calling all of us to an eternal perspective, to see the people that don't get paid attention to see the people that it's easy to dismiss, to see the people that have no power. And he calls us all to respond to them as we believe he would. That might look different for all of us. I came across this quote that I think is so helpful as a starting point. It's a book that we're using as a resource for this series. The book is called Meals with Jesus. It's by a British man named Tim Chester, but he says this: our attitude to the marginalized is to be shaped by our experience of God's grace to us. Our attitude, that's not even action. Attitude, the way that we feel and think and view the marginalized. And again, we know, right now, that is a marginalized people in our world. Did not come here legally, don't know the ways to advocate for themselves, live in fear. And again, they are people, they are not a topic or an issue. So individual people who are marginalized for whatever reason, I don't know that Jesus cares a lot why somebody is crippled or why somebody is poor. He just says, these are people that are outside of your sight line that are marginalized. The way that you think and feel to them is not a fixed point, but is to be in process, and it is to be more and more formed by our experience of God's grace. So think about this for a minute. The more that we experience God's grace, wouldn't that give us more capacity to care for those that are marginalized in our own world? And that might be uncomfortable, because you might have a very fixed opinion that you have done a ton of research on, and you are set and solid in your opinion of what should happen that would fix it for everyone, right? But what if you experienced more of God's grace? Would that even shift? And so Jesus invites us to this trajectory for moving from a temporal, societal, cultural, political lens and says, I want you to have an eternal perspective on people. And so our response is not going to be the same to everyone. But yet, would we all go on the same journey or the same trajectory to get to a place where we can see those that are so easily outside our sight lines, that do not have access to power that not all, but many of us do, resources, care? I think it's so helpful to frame it in terms of attitude. That sentence, our attitude to the marginalized is to be shaped by our experience of God's grace. That is a different lens than one that is shaped by our voting history, what we're registered as when it comes to political parties, our opinions and policy suggestions when it comes to immigration. It's outside of all of that. And those things matter. But Jesus invites us to something else first and foremost and primary. Another conversation I had recently was with a leader of a synagogue here, very close. And in talking with her, she assumed that the church that I was a part of had a paid person who was present at all times when there was somebody in the building for security, and was shocked when I told her, no, we don't have any security. I mean, some of you may view yourselves as security, and please do, that's great. But she said, for the last 2 years, we've had to have somebody paid round the clock whenever we have people using the building, and particularly when we meet in synagogue, because we're under threat. And there's been threats, and we live in fear. We're concerned. We don't know what's going to happen. We hear stories here and stories there. That's a people group that's outside my sight lines. It was a fascinating conversation, very enlightening. How would Jesus have me or have you respond to people who live in fear and in some ways actually have quite a bit of power? Which lines up with another conversation I had with a wife of a police officer friend of mine, who can't understand why she lives in a city that her husband serves, and so many she runs into buys groceries from, and sits behind at stoplights, seems to hate her husband and what he does, and categorizes him with a bunch of other people. And she knows her husband's character, and I know her husband's character, as a good man who loves Jesus, who wants to serve his city. He's never abused his power or misused the law in any way. And there's somebody who has access to power and in many ways feels marginalized. And I'm reminded that we live in a very, very complex city. I think it's the most complex in our nation, maybe. We live in a very important and critical and sensitive time where making broad statements and posting things rarely contribute to what Jesus is about and trying to do. And yet I believe that we, along with a whole lot of other we's around the city that are seeking to follow Jesus and take Scripture seriously, are gathered together and trying to be light in a very dark place, knowing that we share different opinions and have different calls and opportunities of how to serve those who are outside our sight lines, to serve those who live in fear whether they have power or don't have power, to serve a broken humanity in a broken city that Jesus is calling us to. And we get to be the church that models something completely different that no place else in our city gets to model. Joined together by a living, resurrected King who calls us to follow Him first and foremost, and then live a life of sacrifice that's willing to sit at the very back end and be humble, trusting that God's going to use us and work through us in the places and relationships with other people that He brings us in contact with on a regular basis. I really wish I had a clean answer that relieves all the tension. And yet I don't read too many stories where Jesus relieves a lot of tension. But He heightens the call of what we're invited to, of who we are, what our identity is, safe and secure and steady, and to step into a world that is everything but. And so we on a regular basis call ourselves back to this story, this good news, this gospel that's in front of us, that Jesus laid down His life and calls us to believe and trust in His sacrifice and then live as His people in a very broken world. So I'm going to pray and invite you to come to this table as you're led and to take a piece of cracker that represents Jesus' body broken, represent that bread that He broke for us, and then to pick up a little cup of juice that represents His blood shed for us, and to do so with a sense of confidence and empowerment that we can actually sacrifice our own lives for those that are outside many of our sight lines and that need help and need support and need love and need being seen. Jesus, as we come this morning, we want to bring all of our questions, our fears, our confusion, our frustration, our anger. It's so helpful that you identify anger in the parable you told, that the host was angry and embarrassed. Would we be angry at the right things and not just our own pride or security? Would you call us? Would you equip us? Would you empower us to be your hands and feet in this world? And would we find ourselves just shocked and amazed of the individuals, the people, the families that you give us access to and bring us in contact with? And would we be bearers of your good news, of your light, of your hope into this world that needs it desperately?